I'm Susan Lube on Women's Focus, and today I'm talking to Helene Olin about her book, Pound Foolish, which I really liked reading. I just couldn't put it down, I have to say. It's about, you're talking about personal finance as kind of an industry and a way that gets us to not really look at what the real financial situation is of people today. But first, and I don't know if you would agree with that characterization of the book.
Well, it's one of the ways I would look at it. I mean, I really came at this trying to figure out how we had been sold on this idea that if, you know, we did the right amount of personal finance planning, we picked the right investment, you know, you put the right things in your IRA, you stirred, and you would be fine. And of course, you know, from the vantage point of 2009, 2010, when I started this book, that had clearly not worked out for a lot of people. And that was kind of the question I set out to answer with this book. How had we been convinced that personal finance could save us from the economic ravages of the late 20th and early 21st century, that it had the power to make up for income inequality, salary stagnation, an increasingly shaky and contingent workforce, costs of living that were skyrocketing at rates well beyond that of inflation, precarious health care. And how had we come to believe this? And why did we believe this? And that was where I started.
Okay. First, before we go into that, though, let's go back a little bit and talk about how you got into this finance, writing about finances, because that was kind of an interesting story.
It was a true story of the dot-com bubble is what it was. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I was freelancing, and I get a phone call from somebody one day at the LA Times asking me if I knew anything about personal finance and could I sub in for the Money Makeover feature. And all I knew about personal finance was that it paid a heck of a lot more than what I was doing at the time. I mean this literally. I didn't know a mutual fund from Mutual of Omaha, okay? And so I say yes, because, of course, hey, I could use a paycheck, right? And I figure I'm going to do one of these things. I'm going to get a screaming call from the edit desk, and my relationship with the LA Times will be severed and never again to occur. So I run out, buy a copy of Personal Finance for Dummies, and try to actually sound like I know what I'm doing. And while I'm at it, I start asking the subject questions about money and what it means to her in her life, because I've partially got to do something to earn this paycheck. And I think I'm sort of thinking in the back of my head, well, maybe if I write enough about that, they won't notice I don't know what I'm talking about. And I hand this thing in, and I'm waiting for the call. And instead, I get a phone call saying, oh, that was great. Can you do another one? I'm like, oh, sure, whatever, okay. And I go through the whole rigmarole again, and I'm pretty convinced this is the one that's going to end with the screaming call. And of course, doesn't happen. I get another one and another one. And within a couple of months, I have an idea of what I'm doing. And as I always like to say, there's two things you can take away from that story. One is that a lot of personal finance and investments are actually pretty simple stuff. These terms are very basic things. The financial services industry likes to make it seem a lot more complicated than it is so that they can convince you you need their services. On the other hand, I could be an expert because I can't predict the future and neither can anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So my take on the stock market really is no better or worse than your take, which is no better than the vast majority of people running mutual funds or serving as investment advisors out there. Most of us can't beat the market year in, year out. Less than 1% of us seem to have that ability. None of us can tell the future that I'm aware of. And so it's pretty easy, you know. You just tell people what you think. And over the years, I heard people, because I ended up doing this feature for several years, say, you know, real estate would never come back. Again, this was the 1990s. Gold is at its rock bottom at that point. Don't buy gold. It's never going to come back. Conversely, stocks are going up at an average annual rate of 12%. That should, you know, this time it's different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, all of this turned out to be quite wrong.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, you talk about how we're sold on the virtues of the stock market, how the stock market was kind of sold to us. And I think what you use is it depends on what years you look at, that it's not true at all.
Right. I mean, post the Great Depression, I should say, for the longest time, it was a fairly small minority of Americans had money in the stock market. Even as late as the 1980s, so this is after the boom of the 1980s, it's still about somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5. It really only becomes half of us in the late 1990s. a number, by the way, where it still mostly is. You know, we have this idea that everybody's invested in the market. That's just not true.
Okay, 50% about
it's
of people?
It's roughly 50%. It probably went up to 55, 60, you know, around 2006, 2007. People have different numbers on that. It definitely went above 50%. But today it's probably back to about 50%.
Okay.
And it got sold to us over the years. It was very much a deliberate campaign to convince people. You can see it change over time. It was very much preached as your patriotic duty, as a way to fight communism, as a way to impress your girlfriend or wife. It changes with what language they think people are going to respond to.
And who was doing the actual selling? Was it the people who were selling? Was it stockbrokers?
It's across the board. At one point in the 1950s, you actually have a campaign by the New York Stock Exchange itself to convince people that it's our patriotic duty to buy into the stock market as a way of fighting the communist menace. And they even hired the puppet trio Kukla, Fran, and Ollie to do performances on their behalf. It's some of the funniest stuff you'll ever see. And now, of course, it's, you know, investment advisors, because this is how they make their money.
Yeah.
So these days, you know, you see it across the board, and you see the trading firms themselves sell it you on it. And, of course, since our age is so much about wealth and making wealth, a lot of it becomes, for a very long time, all about making wealth. So in the last decade, you know, it was, you know, have the retirement of your dreams, and you show people sailing off on a yacht with Dennis Hopper. Today, you see a lot more of security pitched, you know, that this is, we're going to give you the roadmap. I think it's Fidelity that actually does the little pathway that they show you on television.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm.
We're going to be the guide. But the wealth part is still there. You see, particularly in the pitching of options, is very much this idea that we can make you money and we can make up for the fact you didn't save for retirement. And you see that out there, too. One of the groups that's now really preyed upon are retirees who are, you know, getting 0% interest on their savings and are very scared of outliving their money. And there's a lot of pitches at them. And so I went to this thing called the Money Show in Orlando, which is very set up to appeal to seniors. And there were literally pitches like, seniors, scared of outliving your savings? Come hear us. You know, never worry about money again. Very much appeals to that.
The other thing that you say that I think it's really important for people to hear is that there's no telling, there's no reason that your financial advisor is telling you what's best for you or is able to even assess that.
Right. There's a couple of different strings through here. First, most important, most of us think a financial advisor, and I should say a financial advisor is a kind of junk term that doesn't mean a heck of a lot. It just means somebody who can talk to you about money, which means it could be almost anybody. There's all sorts of credentials out there. But most of us think these people, whoever they are, have a thing called a fiduciary duty to us, which is a duty to act in our best interests, a legal duty. Actually, very few of them have that duty. About 80% of them actually work to something called the suitability standard, which could best be described as, if it's just sort of okay, it's good enough. And that's what they're doing. But again, most of us don't realize it. There is efforts in Washington to reform this. It's sort of hard to know how it's going to turn out, in part because it comes through two different organizations. Your retirement accounts are monitored through the Department of Labor, and the Department of Labor 401ks are already under the fiduciary duty, but your IRA is not, and they're trying to get that expanded. And at your brokerage level, there's been some efforts by the SEC to expand the fiduciary standard to cover brokerages. But so far, that has gone nowhere.
And, of course, there are a lot of people who complain about any kind of attempt at regulation or at making rules.
Right. And, you know, the industry is fighting this tooth and nail. They don't really want it. I mean, not all parts of the industry. Obviously, the parts of the industry that work to the fiduciary standard would love to see the fiduciary standard expanded. Though I have to say that's also becoming a fight, because there's one split off that is encouraging a weakened version of the fiduciary standard to be adapted. And, of course, the people who work to the stricter one are worried about that. So all of this basically ensures nothing happens. And every time there is a push, there are members in Congress who are getting an awful lot of donations from the various parts of the financial services sector who come forward to claim that this is going to hurt the average investor because they're not going to be able to afford to get advice any longer. One of the claims of the financial services industry is that if they actually have to act in their clients' best interests, that it will be unaffordable to them. Which, when you think about it, is amazing because they're basically saying, if I have to do the right thing, my business model is no longer sustainable.
Yeah, right. Oh. The other thing that I was really interested in was the rise of financial literacy. You talk of it as kind of a, not a gang, but another kind of bluff.
Right. I mean, you know, I tell people financial literacy broke my heart because I really thought that this offered promise and could, you know, help us all. And just so for listeners who don't know what I'm talking about, it's the idea that if you teach children in school or adults when they're getting their mortgage how to, you know, read documents and understand what compound interest is, you know, 20 years out, they're going to know what they're doing. And in fact, what we do know is when there are surveys, students who've taken these classes do know better than students who have not, which actually should not come as a surprise because the other thing I discovered is the main organizations pushing financial literacy are the financial services sector, and they're doing it quite deliberately. And it's everything from brand awareness, because, of course, you're now getting your materials with the name Visa or Capital One splashed in front of hundreds of thousands of school kids, to the fact that it's in their interest to convince people in Washington that we can teach people to navigate a 100-page single-spaced gotcha mortgage instead of legislating the fact that you shouldn't be able to sell gotcha mortgages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had no idea that it was so prevalent and that so many companies were pushing it or pushing it so hard.
It was a surprise to me as well, I have to say. I did not include it in the original proposal for my book. It was part of one chapter. It was a question about why, when we had been subjected to so many personal finance gurus and magazines and television shows, no one seemed to know anything more than they did before. And that's where I sort of fell into financial literacy movement.
The other thing that you talk about is how we moved into IRAs instead of the retirement funds that we used to have or that companies used to provide. And that seemed to be sort of slipping into something without even realizing it was happening.
Right. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable. I mean, we look at our retirement landscape, which does not work for anybody, by the way. Mm. The average person has less than $100,000 saved for retirement. And some people think the number is really less than that. Teresa Ghilarducci at the New School, who might be just the preeminent expert on all of this, thinks the number is closer to 30,000. But we think this is a natural landscape, right? When change happens and you take it for granted, you forget it was ever any different. In fact, the 401k starts in the late 1970s as a corporate tax dodge, basically for high-earning executives looking to put some of their pay aside. It is meant to supplement their pensions. It is not meant to take over for the pension system. Mm-hmm. And what happens is an attorney in Washington gets the permission by this time of the Reagan administration to offer these 401ks to everybody, not just these few high-earning executives, to put their money aside on a tax-free basis. And even then, no one realizes what's going to happen, which is corporations, under increased pressure on profits and increased pressure to fund their pensions adequately because of changes in the law, meant to protect pension holders, mind you, instead realize that they could just jettison their pensions and offer workers this newfangled 401k thing, which is exactly what happens. And so over a period of years, you go from something like two-thirds of the workforce being covered by pensions to our situation today, which is less than 20%. And if you took government workers out of the equation, it would be around 10%.
So 10% of people have 401ks?
No, 10% of people have, if they're outside of the war, out of the government, have pensions.
Oh.
401ks, roughly half of us.
Okay.
Believe it or not, about half of us have nothing whatsoever. And that's where individual retirement accounts come in, which is do-it-yourself. It's not even with the aid of your corporation at that point. That's where you put your own money in a ton of way on a tax-deferred basis.
Mm-hmm. And you decide how much?
And you decide how much. And it's, again, not exactly the most efficient method, obviously.
Yeah. And it was interesting that you said that there was a suggestion of 3% or something, or I guess 3% was tax deductible, and so everyone thought 3% was enough?
Well, what it was it's not deductible. What it was companies will often offer a match. You know, so I put, you know, usually it used to be up to 6%, now 3% is more standard, where, you know, the first, you know, a couple of percent of your salary you put in, they will match it.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is, of course, you should be saving between 10 and 20% of your salary for retirement. This, mind you, in a country where the savings rate is about 2% right now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you can tell you right there how realistic this was from the get-go. But the fact is what happened was, is people don't really think this way, right? They don't think about this stuff. So they saw that their company was giving them a 3% match or a 6% match or whatever the match was, and they thought that was the number that they should be saving too. So that's just what they check off. And that problem actually is likely worsening because of what was meant as a very well-intentioned reform, which was automatic retirement savings, which was the idea that previously you used to have to sign up for your 401k. Now they assume you're signed up and you have to sign out of it. But the matches to keep people from signing out are actually quite low, the automatic set takeouts. So instead of taking 10% out like they probably should, they take out 2 or 3% so that people won't go, oh, my God, where's my money, and sign out.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody thinks that they should be putting more in. If they're being told it, it's going in one ear and out the other. Or, frankly, they just can't afford to do it, which is probably an equally as likely a situation. I mean, we live in a country where half of us are truly living paycheck to paycheck right now.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us could not come up with $5,000 on the spot if we had to. And most people are in pretty bad straits. So, you know, how you're expecting them to save 10 to 20% for retirement is not a question anybody seems to be willing to answer.
You talk a little bit about how it seems to be the 70s is when things started to change. I sort of remember the 70s as when people's salaries were frozen during various periods. But you talk a lot about how changes started happening then.
Right. Well, the inflation surge got people to try to make changes. Also, the idea that we needed to supplement pensions. I mean, because keep in mind, I mean, the pension system was not amazing. It was certainly better than what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, like what we have now, it didn't cover a majority of people. It was often not inflation adjusted. So, you know, you live long enough, that starts to become a real problem. And people did try these things as a well-meant supplement to it. Again, the issue is, of course, that they were not meant to be permanent solves. But something else happens in the 1970s, too, and this is really the important part of the story, is in the late 1970s is when the income and salary gaps start to begin to appear. I mean, there's always, of course, income inequality in our country, right? We've
mm-hmm.
never been a pure, you know, everybody equal. Right? That place probably wouldn't be a very great place, actually. But the fact is we were one of the most equal periods post-war that we ever were in our history. And this starts to open up in the 70s, and people start to slowly but surely fall behind. At the same time, they are expected to do more. So you're being thrust out to do more of your own retirement savings, take on more of your health insurance, pay for more of your children's college, at the same time that your salary is falling relative to what somebody would have earned 10 years earlier.
Falling or at the best remaining the same.
Right. And, you know, right now I think the number is from 2000 to 2012. It's over a 10% fall at this point.
Another thing that you just mentioned but you didn't do a paragraph or a chapter about was college loans. And
I really regret not doing this.
I bet. Because that seems to be an industry also.
This is becoming a huge, huge issue. And again, this is something that has more than doubled since 2004, 2005 now. Essentially, what happened is we lost the right to, it was over a gradual period of years. First, it occurred with federal loans and then with private loans to excise our student debt in bankruptcy court. And when we lost the last right to that, which is in the 2005 bankruptcy legislation, frankly, the student loan industry went to town. Because suddenly you have a way of giving people money. You don't have to check if they can pay it back or not, because they're in hock for life, basically. They could garnish your Social Security check. They could garnish your taxes. I mean, you could literally, this is all, literally in some cases, is following people to the grave. Because if you co-sign a loan for somebody who dies, you're on the hook for it, and at least with the private loans, not with the federal loans. And so, no surprise, the amount of debt more than doubles in the next couple of years. And then another part that comes in as well is that the states used to fund a heck of a lot more of the public education system than they did now. In Pennsylvania, they used to fund more than half, for instance. Now the number is less than 20%. And something that happened to me post-writing this book about a month ago is I was doing an article on financial literacy for The Guardian, and April is Financial Literacy Month, and I wanted to point out how ridiculous this was. So I turned to Penn State, which has opened up a new office of financial literacy. Penn State is also judged the most unaffordable or most expensive public college in the country by the U.S. Department of Education right now. So I wrote to the person at Penn State and asked, you know, what she thought financial literacy was exactly going to do in this circumstance. And her response was, well, there wouldn't be a college funding problem if these students could, you know, and their parents were simply planning better, which is just astonishing.
You mean the parents really would have the money if they just planned it better?
Right. I mean, college costs have soared at rates more than double inflation since 1980 at this point. Depending on whether you're talking about a public or private college in 2-year or 4-year, I mean, you're talking potentially 4 times the rate of inflation of schools. And to turn around and blame it on parent planning is astonishing. I mean, really astonishing.
Well, that kind of harkens back to your beginning comment about how people say if you just give up your latte per day, that's all you'll need to do.
Right. I mean, well, this whole idea became that you can do it on your own, right? We didn't need the help of anybody else. We started to fall into this sort of imagined version of the past where, you know, pre the Great Depression and the New Deal, everybody used to help one another and we all lived in happy families. And, you know, when our barn burned down, the neighbors gathered together and helped us build a new barn, right? This is a completely and utterly imagined version of the past. The reason we got Social Security is because the elderly were starting to live a lot longer. And what was starting to happen to them was, unfortunately, a huge number of them were getting ditched in poorhouses if they couldn't convince a child to take them in. And you can see the proof of this, by the way, because in wills previous to the 20th century, you will see things being left to children with the proviso that they would have taken them in during their lifetime. And if they didn't do it, you know, the best bed didn't go to them. This is pretty common. And the same thing, by the way, is true for children who would lose a parent. The example I like to use is the late humorist Art Buchwald. Partly grew up in an orphanage. His mother died, and his father just sent the children off. This is very common. Family abandonment is pretty common stuff. And, you know, we don't think of that way anymore, you know, because we kind of got used to getting help. But we got help for a reason.
Yes, you mean because we needed it.
We needed it. And, you know, and then, of course, times are good after World War II, and slowly but surely we forget.
Well,
and now, of course, it's just this predominant ideology, this sort of, you know, we're Americans and we're the country of Horatio Alger and we're going to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. And as I like to say, you know, this guy was a writer of fiction. We have a class stratification in this country that approaches South America levels. Europe's way ahead of us. We're sitting out there telling people, if you can just give up your latte, you're going to be fine. It is completely and utterly untrue.
Well, there's also the demonization of poor people, especially poor single mothers.
Right. Who, by the way, as according to the Pew Charitable Trust, as of yesterday, have an average household income of $23,000. You know, it's astonishing. I mean, it's almost, I think, our talisman-like way of saying this won't happen to us.
Yeah.
So we say, oh, it won't happen to us. You know, this guy must have just mismanaged his money, or this woman, if she hadn't had a child then and waited 2 more years, she would have been fine.
Exactly.
Of course, none of this is true.
Yes, yes. Well, I have to admit that as I was reading the book, I kept going chapter by chapter and looking for the chapter that was going to say, okay, now I've told you all the things that are wrong, now this is what is right, and you were going to tell me who I should get to advise. advise me as instead of a financial planner, and you know what should I should invest in. And then I finally realized that that was ridiculous, that you would have been equally as critical of doing that also.
Right. I mean, you know, it's a very American thing to want to solve to this, is the thing I've kind of discovered through this book, that we think, you know, that I'm going to criticize the you know, this sort of entire way of being, and then I'm going to have 10 tips for you to make it right.
Yeah.
It doesn't really work that way. It's clearly a much more systemic problem. That being said, of course, there are things to do that can make one's individual situation better. But what I found in the end was that I really wanted to open a conversation. I became very impatient with the books that are all very well meant, you know, that lay out these various forms of the situation economically that we're in right now, and then conclude with, you know, a 10-point plan that we, you know, and I know nobody is paying any attention to at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very worthy, and you throw them aside, and you feel virtuous for reading it. I have found that by ending the book somewhat enigmatically, I've actually had some great conversations in the past year over what can be done, what you think should be done, and how to address it that I just don't think I would have otherwise had. One of the things, for instance, as we've all been made to feel like we are individual failures, right? We don't, you, me, you know, my neighbor, whomever, do not have enough money saved, right?
Yes.
And instead of realizing we're in this group together, that all of us have no money saved, we think we're alone in it. And I really began to feel that we weren't going to get anywhere until we started to acknowledge publicly, you know, that most of us were not in a good place. That part of the problem was that the industry, the collective thinking, whatever you want, however you want to put it, had really sold us on this idea that we were individuals on our own with this. And in fact, that's just not true. But the only way we were going to surmount that was to realize we were all in this together. And I always kind of felt that that, in the end, was the genius of the Occupy movement, was that it was really the first movement in, you know, maybe 30 years that had somebody actually kind of made the linkage of, okay, you're overwhelmed with student loan debt, you're going, you know, you're declared bankruptcy because your wife racked up, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars in bills and your health insurance, medical bills, and your health insurance didn't cover it, and your house is in foreclosure and you can't deal with your bank who won't return, you know, who is putting you through the runaround and will not renegotiate your mortgage. Maybe we all have a problem here. And to me, that was the leap we needed to make as a society before we will really be able to get a handle on this.
And do you think that something could really come of that?
I do think something can really come of that. I mean, you know, as I like to tell people, I mean, you know, that we're even talking about, you know, income inequality is an amazing triumph of that. You know, 5 years ago or 3 years ago, we didn't talk about that.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was known. It wasn't like this is some sudden discovery. It was known as early as the early 1990s that this gap had opened. I actually found a very prescient article by Jane Bryant Quinn about it, of all things, in the early 1990s. But we all thought we were fighting alone.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that has already caused a major change in the discourse.
I guess
how that will end for all of us, I can't tell you, but my feeling very strongly was is that we weren't going to be able to accomplish anything until that point. I would like to point out that in California right now, legislation was passed earlier this year to start providing sort of do-it-yourself pensions for workers who don't have their own, whose employee retirement savings accounts, and that this would be managed by some form of state fund. That is a massive change. That is not something I think would have happened a couple of years ago. And you are beginning to see efforts along these lines. And think of all the action that's going on around student debt.
Yes. And I think also people are realizing that you can have a full-time job and still not make enough to live.
Right. And, you know, one of our things as Americans is we want everything solved tomorrow. And it's all going to be a process, unfortunately. It would be lovely if it would all solve tomorrow, if somebody would help us all out. But, you know, these things take time. And, you know, the first step is to get people to actually admit what's going on. Anybody who's been in a 12-step program can tell you that, right? It's, you know, or knows somebody, you know, you're not getting over it until, you know, you admit that there's a problem.
Yeah.
And for the longest time, we weren't admitting we had a problem. And that's a huge thing.
The other thing that kept coming to my mind when I was reading your book was I've been active in a program called the IDA, the Individual Development Account, that has been successful in New Mexico. And what they say is that you need some kind of asset in order to get out of poverty. You can't just do it right by working. And so they encourage people to, or they match savings and in order to use it to start a business or buy a house or buy a car or something like that. But the savings are small. It's you know, the most is like $5,000 or something like that. And I was wondering if we were just leading people astray, like the financial literacy kind of game.
You know, it definitely helps. Do I think it's enough? And the answer is absolutely not. But there's no question that having an emergency savings will help you if, you know, your car suddenly needs to be towed. One of the programs I've liked that I've seen in the past couple of years has been an initiative to try to get employers to help employees fund an emergency savings account before they they fund their retirement savings. And the thinking is, and it sounds very counterintuitive, right? But the thinking is what we know is 1 in 4 people are now taking emergency loans from their retirement savings. When you do that, you're almost certain to never pay the money back. Okay, so this is gone money. It's also a very expensive way to borrow money. Mm-hmm. You'll have to, if you're under the age of 59, you have to pay a 10% penalty. You know, 401ks, you know, do make money in the long run, but in the short run, there's a lot of fees attached to them. You know, you might be pulling money out in suboptimal times if they're in a stock market account, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a bad place to have your emergency savings, basically. And yet we know a lot of people, because Americans don't have the ability to save 10 to 20% of their incomes, are using their 401ks as de facto savings accounts. So it is actually a huge issue to get people to just build up small accounts. And one of the reasons they don't have them is because there are so many people that are, as you know, banked, which is the financial services sector wants nothing to do with you if you don't have a lot of money. And so they discourage you, actually, from opening a checking or savings account. And this, in turn, forces people into the hands of places like payday loan lenders.
Well, I didn't know they were discouraged. I just knew that a lot of people don't go to banks, but I thought they were intimidated.
No, it's, I mean, some banks are very helpful. I don't want to paint the broadest of broad brushes, but the vast majority, you know, if you have a small account, they're losing money on it. You know, they're putting all these fees on accounts so that you don't open an account.
Oh, gee.
You know, so that, you know, if you don't keep a minimum of, you know, $1,000 in your savings, they're going to charge you for the privilege of checking. Or they have these massive fees, you know, if you bounce a check or something like that.
Yeah, that's true.
And if you're lower income, it can really seem like it's just going to cost you to have the apparatus of a functioning checking and savings account.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can see that. Well, this has been very enlightening. I hope that everyone has been listening and will go out and kind of question what their beliefs are. I'm sure that's what you've been finding as the book comes out.
I have, and what has been fascinating to me is to really watch the impact of some of the ideas in the book, perhaps most dramatically in the financial literacy sphere, where there's really been some much more open acknowledgement now as to what's going on in there, which you just didn't see before, or very much of before I wrote the book. There was some. I mean, there's a wonderful professor at Loyola in Los Angeles named Lauren Willis who has really taken the industry on as well on this issue. But it was very scattered and far between. And that people are simply talking about the issue to me is extraordinary.
That's great. That's great. Again, I'm talking to Helaine Olin, and the name of the book is Pound Foolish, and with the subtitle Exposing the Dark Side of Personal Finance Industry. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.